From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. By now, we all know the story. Several years back, the government deregulated the savings and loan industry, and that move led to the multi-billion dollar SNL crisis. Now the government may deregulate the banking industry, and writer Stephen Pizzo says that could lead to another financial fiasco. On this edition of Fresh Air, Stephen Pizzo tells us why we should worry about the banks. Also today, we talk food with Edward Baer, the writer, illustrator, and publisher of the quarterly newsletter, The Art of Eating. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz explains why not all great chamber music comes from string quartets. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United Nations Security Council voted today to allow Iraq to export $1.6 billion worth of oil to pay for food, medicine, and emergency supplies. The plan calls for unprecedented UN control over the affairs of a sovereign nation. The revenue from the oil sales would be paid into an escrow account controlled by the UN, which would then approve all the purchases that are made. Iraq has rejected the plan as too restrictive and says it won't pump the oil. Most diplomats say, however, that Iraq needs the money badly and will have little choice but to comply. The Iranian foreign minister has called on Britain to put pressure on Israel to release some of its Arab prisoners. In a message to his British counterpart, Douglas Hurd, the Iranian minister accused Israel of obstructing moves to free hostages. Jim Muir filed this report for the BBC from Nicosia.
Mr. Hurd had written to Dr. Velayati expressing Britain's appreciation for Iran's help in securing the release of John McCarthy last week. In a message of reply, according to Tehran Radio, Dr. Velayati told Mr. Hurd that the prospects for freeing the hostages were very favorable, but he accused Israel of creating obstacles. Those obstacles, Dr. Velayati said, could only be overcome by pressure on Israel to release Lebanese and Palestinian hostages, as he called them, especially the radical Shiite cleric Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid. It was up to Britain and other interested parties to take the necessary action, Dr. Velayati said. The United Nations Secretary General, Mr. Perez de Cuellar, must be hoping that despite their tough talk, the Iranians are behind the scenes doing what they can do to help produce the hard evidence about the fate of these seven missing Israeli servicemen, which Israel wants before it considers any release of Arab prisoners.
Jim Muir reporting for the BBC. The Congressional Budget Office is projecting that the federal budget deficit will balloon to more than $360 billion next year and then start gradually shrinking by 1995. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
The Congressional Budget Office and the administration are in relatively close agreement on the size of next year's deficit, citing the savings and loan bailout and rising Medicaid costs as the reason for the higher-than-expected red ink. Where the CBO and the administration differ is in their long-term forecast for the deficit. The CBO sees the deficit beginning to gradually decline by the middle of the decade, but it sees no balanced budgets in sight. The administration, on the other hand, sees the deficit shrinking to as little as $55 billion in 1996. The CBO projects nearly triple that amount. In its report, the CBO agrees with many other analysts in pronouncing the recession over, but it projects only a modest recovery, with the GNP approaching 3.5% in 92, accompanied by an increase in short-term interest rates. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost 7 points today to close at 2,998. This is NPR. Iraq said today that it's close to agreement on an autonomy plan with the northern Iraqi Kurds, but Kurdish rebels charge that the government is actually sending more troops to the region. Iraq's interior minister said that an agreement on Kurdish autonomy will be announced soon. A Kurdish rebel spokesman outside Iraq said that the Iraqi army has been deploying more troops in the north, especially around the oil center of Kirkuk. Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton is one step closer to making a decision about a 1992 presidential bid. Ben Fry of member station KUAR reports.
Governor Clinton announced today he will step down from the chairmanship of the Democratic Leadership Council and form an exploratory committee to test the waters for the Democratic presidential nomination. In a press conference today in Little Rock, Governor Clinton said his past 11 years as governor of Arkansas have convinced him there needs to be a change in the federal government.
Ever since the beginning of the Reagan administration, you've seen, in effect, more and more responsibilities for our nation's future economic development, trade, education, social policy being put back on the states, away from the federal government. And the thing that has kept me in this is that I honestly believe that someone who has lived with these problems firsthand should try to address them.
The governor says he will make a formal decision by the end of September. For National Public Radio, I'm Ben Fry in Little Rock.
Rescue officials in Hong Kong say that time is running out for the effort to find survivors from a barge that capsized and sank today in the South China Sea. At least 13 people are believed to have been killed. The barge was carrying almost 200 oil pipeline workers, and rescuers say that 174 of them were rescued in heavy seas. 8 people are still missing, including 4 divers who were trapped in a decompression chamber attached to the barge. Officials said that the men had an air supply expected to last until about an hour ago. I'm Corey Flintoff in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Legislation deregulating commercial banks is moving through Congress and is expected to come up for a vote in the Senate this fall. Among the issues being considered are laws that would allow banks to sell insurance, cross interstate lines to open branches, and return to the securities business. We're all too familiar with what happened to the savings and loan industry after Congress deregulated the thrifts. Stephen Pizzo, in an article in the upcoming issue of Mother Jones magazine, says he fears that commercial banks will face the same troubles as the SNLs. Pizzo is a freelance writer and author of Inside Job, The Looting of America's Savings and Loans. He also writes for the trade publication National Thrift News. Pizzo has been following the banking industry since the early 80s.
Well, I was running a real estate investment company actually in Northern California in 1980, 1981, and had an opportunity to buy something that was not real estate. It was a newspaper that was going out of business, and I picked it up cheap, and I knew nothing about journalism at the time. But it intrigued me, and it was in a small town, and I had visions of becoming the town's Mark Twain. I began to run the thing, and as coincidence would happen, it was October of 1982 when I really took over this newspaper, the very same time that Congress deregulated the SNL industry and President Reagan signed the Garn-St. Germain Act into law. And we had a small savings loan in this town where the newspaper was, Centennial Savings Loan. And as a real estate broker, I began to notice, again, I was not a journalist, but I was a real estate broker, and I began to notice that a lot of the real estate deals this savings loan was doing were like nothing I had ever seen before. And I began to follow their activities, and that led to the publication, I guess, some 5 years later of our book.
In investigating thrifts, did that naturally lead to commercial banking? Are these really twin systems?
Well, in a lot of ways, yes, in the sense that a lot of the people we found looting savings and loans around the country had come originally from the banking industry. Banking had been a little bit more freewielding than savings and loans had been before they were deregulated. Savings loans, of course, were relegated to just making home loans until 1982. So the crooks were really over at the banks. They'd always been there, sort of traditionally been there, for the same reason Willie Sutton and Bonnie Clyde had been there, because that's where the money was. But when Congress deregulated the SNLs, they moved wholesale over into the SNL business and looted it into insolvency. Now, the same people, I might add, most of them are not in jail, as we well know, are back in the banking industry. And what they're waiting for now is for Congress to deregulate that industry.
You're talking about crooks. You're talking about looting. Do you think of these people as robbers?
Oh, absolutely. These people are sociopaths. They're some of the best criminal minds of our time. And I think one of the real crises, you know, we hear about the SNL crisis. I think America's facing a more serious crisis than just the SNL crisis. And that is coming to terms with the concept of white-collar crime. I might say white-skinned crime, too, because it's that also. These people do not fit the image that Americans have of criminals. They're not threatening. They're not inner-city people. They wear suits and ties and drive around in stretch limos. But I'll tell you, they're as big a crooks as have ever walked the face of this earth. And they are one of the prime reasons that we are $500 billion lighter on the SNL side of the balance sheet.
I think what some of these people might say to you is that they are just taking advantage of laws and regulations that Congress set forth.
Well, you know, they certainly did that. I won't argue with that. And Congress got paid very well by these people. Congress became really the net beneficiary of the larceny that they unleashed on the SNL industry, because these people knew that unless they shared with Congress, Congress could change the law back to the way it was before. So they were shoving, they were tithing, they were sending a portion of their booty off to Washington during this whole thing, which is one of the reasons why we ended up with the Keating Five and a number of other congressmen and senators who threw themselves between these crooks and regulators when the regulators tried to to yank them out of their shops.
What do you think the lessons of the SNL crisis are?
Well, the lessons are that when you have federal deposit insurance, when the government is going to underwrite this kind of activity, that you want to have, first of all, very little activity, so it's easy to regulate and to monitor. You need a lot of examiners, and you need to fund that system so that you can have regular examinations of these institutions to make sure that they're toeing the line.
Let's go back just a couple of decades. What safeguards were instituted after the 29 crash and the Depression to prevent banks from further and future collapse?
Well, in 1929, we lost about 10,000 banks, a lot of them because of the fact that they were speculating the stock market with their depositors' money. Now, there was no federal deposit insurance in those days, and that precipitated a run on the rest of the banks in this country. So Congress instituted federal deposit insurance, and it also instituted the Glass-Steagall Act, which banned banks from mucking around in Wall Street anymore. And that law has been on the books. The banks hated it. The banks liked deposit insurance, but they hated the Glass-Steagall Act, and they have been tireless in their efforts to get it overturned and be chipped away at it, and it looks like now they are approaching success in that regard.
It seems to me that banks have two major responsibilities. One is to be a safe place where individual people, where companies can put their money, and I assume part of that investment then provides a kind of stability to the economy. They also need to turn a profit. Do you see these as kind of mutually exclusive responsibilities, and can they do both, do you think, in the 90s?
Well, the public is being purposely confused on this whole issue of the state of the American banking industry. The public should understand there are really two banking industries in America. There are 12,500-odd banks in this country. 9,500 of those banks are small and medium-sized community banks. You know, the bank that knows your name when you walk in the door, they're small-town banks, they finance small local businesses, they finance local farmers and whatnot. Then you have the rest of them, and these are your large and your mega-large, your money center banks, your Citicorps, your Hanovers, your Chemicals, your Bank of Americas. That is the segment of this industry that's in trouble. Now, why are they in trouble? Well, they're in trouble because during the 80s, they abandoned their traditional customer base, small business, consumer loans, home construction, and they went chasing after the brass ring. They went after financing and participating in leverage buyouts. They went into financing and participating in commercial development craze around this country that has resulted in massive overbuildings of office buildings, which are now sitting vacant. And they lent tons of money to the developing countries, the third world, on the theory that, geez, you know, why make 10 million dollar loans to a bunch of small business people and then have to kind of count those payments every month? Let's make one $100 billion loan to Brazil, and then we have only one monthly payment every month to count. We'll fire the servicing department and save money. Well, that works fine, except that they neglected what everybody else in the world knew, that in Central America, the national treasury belonged to whoever had the key that week, and a lot of that money just disappeared. Now, anybody could have told them that, but they did it anyway.
Stephen Pizzo is my guest, and he's a journalist. He has an article in the September-October edition of Mother Jones on efforts in Congress to deregulate the banking industry. The article is called The Trillion Dollar Question, and in the article, Stephen Pizzo warns that deregulation will do to banks what it did to savings and loans. Are you saying that, on the whole, that the banking industry in this country is healthy?
Yes, you bet. The banks that stayed with their traditional markets are healthy. In fact, I want to also add the savings and loans that did not avail themselves of their expanded powers, the ones that simply stuck to owner-occupied home lending, they're still around and they're profitable too. It's the savings and loans that went out after that brass ring that fell off their horse and broke their neck. Same thing goes for the banks.
If there are, though, these regulations, these rules and regulations that banks have to follow, how were these so-called large, mega-large banks able to then go for this brass ring if in the end they were very shaky investments?
Well, you have to understand that a banker doesn't... If an investment is shaky, that's the kind of thing you and I would consider if we were investing our own money. This is not their money. This money is depositors' money, which is federally insured. So it is a classic heads they win, tails we lose situation. If they go out with this money and gamble on some leveraged buyout or some big commercial development and they make a fortune on it, they get to not only keep the points and the fees that they are able to pocket on making the loan, but then there are also their participation in the project. If they lose, though, and the bank ends up failing because of that, then the taxpayer picks up the loss.
Why would they want, though, their own bank to fail?
Well, they don't want it to fail. But again, the incentive to be careful there is not the same incentive that you and I have when we're investing our own money. They're gambling with other people's money, and not only is it other people's money, but it's federally insured other people's money. I mean, some investment advisors that gamble with other people's money, if they lose it, those investors can turn around and sue him or her. Here with a bank, nobody's going to sue them because, the federal government might. But the depositors are not going to care because the day the bank closes, the government's standing there with a check for them to cover their deposits. So they don't have the kind of constraints and worries when they make their investment that the person working with their own money does.
I'm speaking with Stephen Pizzo, and he's a journalist. He has an article in the September-October edition of Mother Jones on efforts in Congress to deregulate the banking industry. The article is called The Trillion-Dollar Question. And in the article, Pizzo warns that deregulation will bring down banks in this country. And he testified before the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee this past summer, arguing against bank deregulation. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with journalist Stephen Pizzo. Who is calling for bank reform?
Well, primarily the Association of Bank Holding Companies, which is the lobby group for that large sector of banking, the mega banks. They represent them, and the Bush administration are calling for it. And the lobby group that I just mentioned is paying very well. I mean, people ask now, how on earth did we ever deregulate SNLs? Why did Congress do that? Well, for the reason that Congress does a lot of stupid things. They were paid to do it. Back in 1981, 1982, the U.S. League of Savings Institution, which was the main lobby group for SNLs, was just shoving a ton of money to members of the House and Senate banking committees. Now we have the Association of Bank Holding Companies doing the same thing, and so far they've shoved about $3.5 million to just the 52 members on the House Banking Committee.
You're brushing this whole issue with some very broad strokes, and you seem to be implying that the banking industry, white men in fancy suits, cannot be trusted.
Well, I think we saw that already with the SNL industry. I don't know how many more times we have to learn this lesson. Congress tends to rely far too much on its reliance on what it calls firewalls. For example, they say, well, we can let banks into the securities business because they're going to have a securities holding company, but the regulations are going to say that the bank can't make loans to its securities trading subsidiary to prop it up. Well, there were firewalls like that in the SNL business. For example, an SNL owner was not supposed to make loans out of his own SNL to himself or his companies or his partners. But what they did was they just found another SNL crook who would make loans to him, and he'd make loans to them, and they'd link up into these 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 thrift daisy chains where they just made loans to one another in a big round circle until they had looted one another's SNLs into insolvency. Now, what will the banks do with that kind of a technique? Well, let's look at this scenario. You've got Citibank and Bank of America and Manny Hanny. They've all got their securities trading subsidiaries now, and they're really cooking. And all of a sudden, we hit a Black Monday, an October 19th, 1987 again, and the market starts plummeting. Well, we're not going to take them very long to realize that all I have to do is pick up the phone and that other banks have securities trading subsidiaries too, and they'll say, listen, Bank of America, you make loans to our clients, we'll make loans to your clients until this whole thing is over, and then we'll settle these accounts. And it's better to have a few angry regulators around saying we violated the spirit of the law than to fail. And that's exactly what they'll do. And in the twinkle of a couple of program trades, we'll see a few billion federally insured dollars go right down another rat hole. I guarantee you they'll do that. In fact, if you want an object lesson from history, Continental Illinois Bank. It cost the government $4.5 billion to bail out Continental Illinois. And in October 1987, Black Monday, when the stock market crashed, Continental made $385 million in loans to its own stock options trading subsidiary in direct violation of the law, and regulators who were in the bank at the time did not act. In fact, they participated in it by ruling that the loans were actually necessary if Continental was going to survive. So the lesson here is that when a bank gets so big that its failure can disrupt the financial markets, that even the regulators, the cops, are going to be forced to go along with the banker's desperate and often illegal attempts to survive. That's the lesson.
What makes deregulation so irresistible to Congress, do you think?
Money. Look, they're being paid for it now in the form of huge campaign contributions, and they learned that after they deregulated savings and loans, they opened up an absolute treasure chest of money that was coming to them out of these high-flying savings and loans that were just shoving money to Washington like it was coming out of a high-pressure fire hose. They missed those days, quite frankly. And they know that if they deregulate banks, they'll reopen that spigot.
Why, logically, though, would Congress ignore or bring on another crisis in the proportion or probably even in greater proportion than the S&L crisis when it's so clear that the country is suffering, having to pay the bills for the current S&L crisis? Why would Congress want another banking crisis?
Well, I don't know. And I think they're kidding themselves. I think they're in denial. They've been listening to these bankers who are extremely persuasive and throw a lot of economic arguments out there. They bring in a lot of economists to tell them this is absolutely necessary. And you've got Alan Greenspan himself, the Federal Reserve chief, backing this to the hilt. I asked Congress when I spoke to them why it was that nobody seemed to remember that it was in 1985 that it was the same Alan Greenspan, then a private consultant, who was sitting in front of them in the employ of none other than Charles Keating, who'd paid him $40,000, to come and tell Congress that Lincoln Savings Alone was a great thrift, doing great things, and was, quote, no threat to the insurance fund. This is the same man who called those shots completely wrong, because now, of course, we know that Lincoln is going to cost taxpayers maybe as much as $3 billion by the time it all shakes out. So Congress tends to listen to people even when they've been proven wrong in the past.
So you're saying hundreds of people in Washington, D.C. are in denial?
Apparently so, because this legislation is sliding right through.
Where is the legislation? And I know that the Senate and the House Banking Committee have both passed some bills regarding bank reform.
The House Banking Committee has passed the bill, which pretty closely mirrors the Bush administration's original proposals, which would allow banks to get into the securities business, to sell insurance. We all know how well insurance companies are doing now, don't we? And allow corporate ownership, allow companies like General Electric and Exxon to own their own banks. The Senate Banking Committee has not yet issued forth its bill. It's still arguing over the issue of corporate ownership, but other than that, it's prepared to let banks back in on Wall Street and to sell insurance and such. Meanwhile, the legislation on the House side is held up in Senator Dingell's committee. It was Congressman Dingell, Representative Dingell, whose father in 1933 argued so eloquently for the Glass-Steagall Act. So it's interesting to see that it's now his son who is a roadblock against letting banks back into the securities market again, 60 years later.
I'm speaking with Stephen Pizzo. He's a journalist, and we're talking about efforts to deregulate the banking industry. Can you have deregulation with greater oversight? Would that take care of part of the problem?
Well, you need greater oversight if you're going to deregulate, that's for sure. But the way that the kind of bill that has come out of the House Banking Committee, if it were to pass into law, would allow banks to do all of this in the stroke of a pen, branch interstate, which they've not been able to do before, get into the securities business, form their own insurance companies and sell that insurance to their banks. All of this going on all at once, it's going to create an absolutely impossible regulatory environment. By the way, again, I keep hearkening back to the S&L crisis. That's the thing regulators will tell you now. S&L regulators will tell you happened in 1982. Congress deregulated the thrift industry in a careless way, allowing them to get out in the non-traditional areas. And the poor examiners were going into these thrifts. And a month earlier, all they had to examine were a bunch of very easy-to-understand home loans. 6 months later, they show up, and here the same thrift has investments in Wendy's restaurant franchises, windmill farms to generate electricity. And these poor examiners are looking and saying, how am I supposed to value these investments? How am I supposed to know if they're sound? And in the end, for the first few years, all they did was take the savings loan owner's word for it. Is this a good investment? You bet. Well, that's what's going to happen with the banks, too. It's going to be a frenzy out there, a feeding frenzy, as big banks go around this country and gobble up, Pac-Man-style, the small community banks, which who are happy and not in trouble right now. But the big banks will get out there and acquire them all around this country in a mad feeding frenzy to build their branching structure.
Where was the public outcry about the S&O crisis, and why isn't the public concerned about what's happening to the banking industry?
Well, you know, this is really the sad. You know, we do get the kind of government we deserve as a country, and I guess we get the kind of scandals we deserve, too. The public considers banking a big yawn. The press considers it a big yawn. When S&L deregulation was being debated in Congress, you go back and read in the press, you're going to find very little written about it. Didn't seem consequential at the time, kind of a strange little boring business story. Same thing's happening now with the banking crisis. Nobody is really covering this in a probing and questioning way. Nobody is really making the comparisons between the savings loans and the banking situation. And the administration, by the way, keeps saying there is no comparison. There is no comparison. These are very different. Well, what do you mean they're different? Where is the difference? Banks are federally insured. Banks take in deposits. Bank makes loans. Where's the different part of this story that I don't understand?
Is that the frustration I hear in your voice?
Yeah, it has a Mad Hatter's Tea Party quality to it when I sit here and I see Congress listening to people like Alan Greenspan tell them that, you know, now we have to deregulate the banks. You know, they're using the same words. You go back, read the testimony before Congress in 81 and 82. They're saying the S&Ls are not competitive. We need more powers. We need expanded powers. We need more services for our customers. The customers weren't asking for any more services. The S&L guys were asking for the expanded services. But anyway, they're using the same exact arguments. So I sit here and I listen to all this and I say, you know, where is everybody's institutional memory here?
What then safeguards would you and reforms would you institute in the banking industry?
Well, I would basically say what we need in this country is to go back, not forward. We need a conservative base banking industry in this country that makes loans to small business. If we allow banks to be owned by giant corporations. We have these big mergers like we saw with Bank of America and Security Pacific this week. What we're going to end up with is a few huge tumor-like banks that are very tuned into the corporate culture, but not into small business. And you'll see credit from these banks flowing to the corporate culture and starving small business. Well, I've got news for America. Corporations do not create jobs in America. They move jobs out of America. 2/3 of the job creation in America comes from small and medium-sized domestic businesses, and they're not going to get the credit they used to get from banks. The result will be we'll end up with small businesses being starved out, unemployment going up, and Congress having to create some small business administration program on a much more expanded basis, which, of course, will supply credit to small business, but will be mismanaged and will end up costing the taxpayer money. It ain't broke. Don't fix it. Now, if these big banks want to get out in the international community and want to get out into the stock market and sell insurance and stuff, I have nothing against that. Let them do it. But let them relinquish their deposit insurance for the portion of their funds they use for that kind of activity. They say they want to be competitive. Well, I've got news for them. Over in the British banks don't have the kind of deposit insurance we have here. They have 70% up to $25,000. That's all they have. And many banks in the world, Japanese banks included, don't have any at all. So they want to be competitive? Give up their deposit insurance and go to it, guys. But not with my money.
Where do you put your money?
Well, I put it in the banks. I mean, you know, it's safe in the banks. I mean, the government's going to, that's not where they're going to get you. You're not going to lose your money if a bank fails. You're going to lose your money on that bottom line on your 1040 for the next 30 or 40 years while you're a taxpayer, because that's where they're going to get you.
Stephen Pizzo, thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Marty.
Stephen Pizzo is a journalist. His article about the banking industry is in the upcoming issue of Mother Jones magazine. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. What's the best mustard in the world? What makes a really good carrot? How do you fix wild boar? Those are just a few of the topics Edward Baer examines in his quarterly newsletter, The Art of Eating. Coming up, Baer tells us how he made a business and a life out of fine food. And there's a new pair of recordings of Brahms performed by the Boston Chamber Music Society. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says they're superb recordings and brilliant performances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has signed a measure that rewrites the rules requiring the White House to give Congress advance notification of covert intelligence operations. NPR's Richard Gonzalez has more on the story.
Under the new law, the White House must put in writing the president's authorization of any covert action by any agency of the U.S. government, including the National Security Council. The new law is the result of a compromise between the White House and Congress. President Bush vetoed a previous attempt by Congress to reform the notification process, saying that Congress was infringing on his authority to conduct foreign policy. But the president, in a letter last year, promised he would inform congressional oversight committees prior to any covert operation in most instances. And when that isn't possible, he would notify Congress within a few days. The new law was designed to prevent the administration to keep its activities secret in the wake of the Iran-Contra affair. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
In New York City, the UN Security Council has agreed to allow Iraq to export $1.6 billion worth of oil in order to buy needed food and medicine. 30% of the money will go to pay Persian Gulf War expenses. The sale will be under UN supervision, and revenue will be paid into a UN-controlled escrow account and approved by UN personnel. Iraq would have no control over its oil revenue. A federal judge in Detroit has barred the public schools there from opening three controversial all-male schools. The American Civil Liberties Union and the National Organization for Women's Legal Defense Fund charged that the schools would discriminate against girls. Phil Denieri of member station WDET reports.
Detroit School Board, in an attempt to combat the high dropout and crime rates plaguing the city's black male youth, had planned to open three special schools for those students this year. The all-male academies would feature small classes, an Afrocentric curriculum, and special mentors. Detroit was preparing to be the first public school system to implement so extensive a program when the ACLU and Now Legal Defense Fund filed suit against the schools last week. Those groups, representing a Detroit mother and her three daughters, argue that the Constitution prohibits such discrimination. A federal judge today agreed with those groups. He said there was nothing in the mission of the schools that justified leaving girls out. For National Public Radio, this is Phil Denieri in Detroit.
U.S. health officials are warning travelers to South America to avoid eating raw fish and drinking unclean water because of the danger of cholera. There have been 15 cases of cholera reported among tourists coming back from South America. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 7 points to close at 2,998.43 on volume of some 174 million shares. Trading today was active. This is NPR News. Israeli officials have indicated that a speedy end to the hostage problem is not possible. Israeli Defense Minister Aaron says, perhaps through talk and media coverage, hopes are being raised that cannot be sustained, adding there must be patience. Aaron's also said that no additional information has been gained through diplomatic efforts by the UN Secretary General. Israeli officials have said that they will not take part in a trade unless there is solid information about 7 missing Israeli servicemen. Bad weather has hampered rescue operations in the South China Sea, where a barge sank. Officials in Hong Kong say that 12 people are known dead, and rescuers are trying to reach 4 divers trapped in a diving bell that went down with the barge. Humphrey Hawksley filed this report for the BBC.
It's not known whether the 4 men are still alive in the diving chamber, only that their oxygen supply was due to run out early tomorrow morning, Hong Kong time, Two specialist divers have flown to Hong Kong from Singapore. One has gone straight to the rescue area. The other is speaking to survivors to find out more details about how the barge capsized and where the chamber is likely to be. The oil workers had left their rigs and were on the barge to sail away from the approaching typhoon. But the storm quickly caught up with them, and the barge began taking water in the early hours of the morning. Helicopter crews told how waves up to 50 foot high swept survivors more than 5 miles from where the vessel went down, and that they were struggling amid the wreckage from the barge to keep afloat.
Humphrey Hawksley in Hong Kong. In Germany, the central bank has raised key lending rates in a move to curb rising inflation. The bank raised its discount rate by 1% to 7.5% in a move that was sharply criticized by German businessmen. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. If much of the world feeds these days on fast food, what Edward Baer writes about is slow food. Good, slow food. Food that takes time to find, to prepare, and to enjoy. Elegy for the taste of cream, the pursuit of the fundamental loaf, and an aged country ham. These are a few of the subjects he's delved into in his quarterly newsletter, The Art of Eating, in essays as lengthy and in-depth as a New Yorker profile. But he often follows his pieces with a recipe. For almost 5 years, Baer has been writing and illustrating his quarterly at his home in Peacham, Vermont. His wife, Grace, prints it in her shop a couple of towns over. It seems as though everyone these days is worried about how much fat and fiber is in the average American diet. But that's not Baer's concern.
I guess I'm not really writing for the nation. I mean, I think that what Julia Child did and does was to, she wanted everybody to eat better, I think, you know, whether as a moral mission or just as an approach. And I'm not maybe as optimistic as she. I don't think I can do much about that. And I think that at the very extreme end, and I don't mean the high end of price, but at the far end of the spectrum, which is, I guess, connoisseurship, though that's, you know, it starts to get hoity-toity when you use words like that. That's where too little work has been done in finding out what good. Well, I when people ask me what my subject is, my best answer, I guess, is I'm interested in what good food is and what makes it good. It's a question that hasn't been answered very well. It hasn't even been asked very often. So I'm trying to ask it for different foodstuffs, especially, and to answer it.
I noticed that in writing about food, you seem to have the same arsenal of adjectives, I think, that a wine connoisseur has to have in writing about wine. You write about the concentrated flavor of mature carrot or the bitter and astringent flavor of a walnut. And I wonder whether that writing comes from your taste buds or your thesaurus.
Well, both, actually. It should certainly come from the taste buds. It's an interesting point. First of all, what you may not realize, and I only partly know, but understand more and more, is that wine has been written about so much by so many people in so many countries over such a long period of time that it is not possible to avoid well-worn adjectives with wine. And then what I have come to realize is that the same... Well, you're talking about the same taste, whether you're talking about food or a liquid. And so you need those same adjectives. And the only difference is that they have been used perhaps a little less with food. And in wine, you know, it's so concentrated, especially with French wine. They've been writing about the same wines from the same places in the same way over so long. In food, it isn't quite as true. I mean, the whole thing about wine is, at least in my mind, I think having just come back from California, even in the minds of California winemakers, is that wine is connected to place. And one of my especial interests in food is the connection of the food to the place. And that's why I've written about foodstuffs and when I have, or the raw materials, and when I have, I've tried to connect them to the extent possible with a particular place and the influence of that place.
I think that's also true for someone just eating a meal, that so much of the context and so much of the people sitting across from you and how you mm-hmm. feel about them, that really does influence the taste of food.
Yeah, absolutely. And even people who may taste wine as a part of their livings would agree with that, even the ones who are assigning those precise numbers to the wines to say just how good they are.
Do you buy most of the food that you eat from local farmers, from local dairy farms?
Well, yes and no. In summer, we have a good-sized garden. To the extent that it's possible, yes, and to the extent that it doesn't take a lot of time and driving, because when you're in the country, you have to get in the car to go almost anywhere. We do have local milk from a small. We have sometimes in the past bought it out of baled it out of a farmer's bulk tank, but we now get pasteurized milk that from a farmer who has I think 11 Jerseys. And he's commercial, believe it or not, and organic, certified organic.
I'm speaking with Edward Baer, and he is the quarterly The Art of Eating, and he writes, illustrates, and publishes the newsletter from Peacham, Vermont, where he lives. And the newsletter has all sorts of essays on a whole host of food issues, from apples, mustard, wild boar, carrots, bread, you name it. We're going to take a short break and talk some more. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Edward Baer, and he writes and illustrates and publishes the quarterly newsletter called The Art of Eating. You have in one of your quarterlies an essay about apples entitled Apples, 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 and I'd love to have you read just the first two paragraphs.
Okay. Possibly, the best apple I ever ate was a wealthy that I picked one cool, sunny September day some years ago from the last living branch of an old tree in an abandoned farm orchard. But not many orchardists would be impressed by my best claims for a wealthy. Apple people and books usually rate it slightly below the top varieties. Yet the deep roots of the dying tree may have concentrated an exceptional store of energy into the final display of fruit. The tree was dead the next year. And if so, the wealthy I ate was far above the usual run. I recall that was a good year for apples, perhaps especially for wealthy. And it was the kind of fine day on a hilltop that opened the senses. So often one is distracted and doesn't really taste things. And, of course, things remembered are almost always better. Apple flavor is a complicated, contentious matter. Almost before you begin to speak about varieties, some orchardists will warn you there is no such thing as a best apple. Even so, variety is the most important factor in apple flavor as it is in other fruits and vegetables, but the tree must be well tended and it must grow in the right soil in a favorable climate. One's opinion as to the best variety is not only a question of preference, but of chance. What apple varieties have you tasted and which were in top form at the time? Was the apple mature or underripe, or settling into a soft, flat decline? Not every apple on the tree ripens at once, and for all of them, a few days or a week makes a difference. One's apple notions vary according to where one has lived or perhaps traveled in apple season. What do you call delicious in an apple? My own count of varieties has been boosted by the many nameless ones I've collected along back roads. Alerted by good-sized windfalls lying in a dusty semicircle at the edge of the road, I pull over, or I tromp through an overgrown field to some beckoning, unkempt tree, far from a house and so unclaimed, I hope. Such apples are most often disappointing, but they are an education in the near-infinite diversity of apple flavor.
How do you select your topics?
Good question. I have, in theory, a list of subjects that I'm going through, for the quarters ahead or the year or two ahead. Sometimes, though, it's very pragmatic. It's something that I can research in the time allowed, and I'm always accumulating information on subjects, accumulating knowledge, and stuffing things into a file or something. If I'm not ready to write it, even though in theory it's on my schedule, I won't. But sometimes it seems more happenstance, and it's the question of having to make a choice because the time is passing.
You have an essay on eating wild boar.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that come from?
Well, I'm interested in the tastes of wildness, and I like pork a lot, and it of course domesticated pigs come from wild boars. And I found a source of wild boar, so I pursued it. And it is sort of domesticated wild boar. That is, these boars are fenced in, they roam about, but they're also, this fellow feeds them grain because he's afraid that they'll taste too wild and he won't be able, he sells the meat. He's afraid that he won't be able to sell the meat if it's too forceful.
Do you find if you're writing an article or an essay about wild boar that you eat wild boar sandwiches, wild boar mm-hmm. soup, wild boar salad?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, you just kind of immerse yourself in this particular taste yeah. that you want to write about.
Yeah, and part of it, alas, is pressure of time because you're trying to come to conclusions and you can't come to conclusions without eating, without tasting, so you tend to concentrate, yes.
Do you ever lose your appetite to the point that sort of like people get writer's block, you might get kind of taste block?
I don't remember that ever having happened. There might be things I get tired of eating, but no appetite block. No.
That hearty appetite continues.
Yeah, it's genetic. It's inborn. I don't know.
Now, you're working on a quarterly for the next season. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're writing about?
Well, I've written very little about wine before. I once did a long piece on beer. And I'm writing a piece on the Sauvignon Blanc grape. It's a California piece, and I'm making some of those connections with wine and the wine vocabulary more closely.
Are you also expanding your geographic horizons by getting out of Peacham, Vermont?
Well, it doesn't hurt. I was so poor during the early years that I was doing this that travel still sort of feels like escape sometimes. But yes, that's definitely true. And I was just in Sonoma County, and I only wish that I could have spent more time driving back roads and knowing it as well as I know Vermont, or somewhat as well.
Did you have people say to you, what are you doing writing this quarterly? It's in black and white. There are no there are no ads inside. Mm-hmm. It has a kind of simple, elegant style to it. Do people still ask you, what are you doing?
They don't ask me what I'm doing. You mean because it's so uncommercial?
Yeah.
A few people, especially businessmen who make a fair amount of money, find it incomprehensible because they don't realize that you can live on much less money than they live on, I guess, and they may not realize that Vermont is a cheaper place to live than many places, and they multiply the number of subscribers times the subscription price, and they look at me quizzically.
Well, you know, I have to confess to you, while we were waiting to get hooked up with you, I took 1,800 times 22 to figure out how much you make a year.
Yeah, well,
it's not much.
Yeah, last year, only because my wife has a decent job and has kindly helped to support me. But this year, I'm doing extremely well, and sold back issues and so on, and the book is coming out, and I think that at the end of the year, when I look at the books, I will say that you know, in terms of in financial terms or in terms of keeping going for as long as I want, I will have made it.
Edward Baer, thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Edward Baer, that's B-E-H-R, is the writer and publisher and illustrator of the quarterly newsletter, The Art of Eating, and he does it all from his home in Peacham, Vermont. A collection of his essays will be out early next year from Atlantic Monthly Press. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Marty. Today we'll be hearing news about President Bush's signing the bill governing covert actions by the Central Intelligence Agency. We'll also hear disclosures about the super gun, the huge artillery piece that Iraq was building in the hopes of firing a weapon either at Israel or, if they'd finished it in time, possibly at U.S. troops who were stationed in Saudi Arabia during the war. We'll hear an odd little item about how Hong Kong is going to be making a retroactive contribution to the war effort by selling less clothing in this country, and also a talk with young country singer Kelly Willis.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. We tend to think of the string quartet as the core of the chamber music repertory, but some of the greatest chamber music is not for the string quartet, which is why classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's especially grateful for the two new Brahms recordings by the Boston Chamber Music Society.
There's some wonderful chamber music that we don't get to hear as often as we'd like, because in order to perform it, a traditional string quartet ensemble would have to invite additional string, wind, or keyboard players. To deal with this problem, larger and more flexible groups like the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center and the Boston Chamber Music Society were formed. The Boston group, now in its 10th year, has about a dozen regulars. They haven't found the perfect configuration for every composer. Mozart, for instance, tends to elude them, but their Brahms has been exceptional, so they were wise to devote the first two recordings of their projected 10-disc series to Brahms. The basic classical repertory from Bach to Bartok, Brahms may still be the most controversial composer. The cholesterol level may be too high for contemporary taste. There's a heaviness to sweetness ratio that some people may find unhealthy. But these performances are warm, flowing, and impassioned without the thick over-assertiveness that often ruins Brahms. Sometimes they even make Brahms sound quite modern. Two of Brahms's greatest chamber works, a trio and a quintet, center on the clarinet. The Boston Chamber Music Society's eloquent clarinetist is Thomas Hill. His partners in the clarinet quintet are cellist Ronald Thomas, who is the co-founder of the group, along with the elegant violinists Arturo Delmoni and Lin Chang, and that vigorous viola virtuoso Marcus Thompson. The second Boston Chamber Music Society disc includes the piano trio in B major and the C minor piano quartet. The trio, Opus 8, is one of Brahms's earliest works, and it retains its youthful quality even though Brahms thoroughly revised it 35 years later. The pianist here is Christopher O'Reilly, who is one of the most exciting and satisfying younger performers on the circuit. The trio gains in size and dynamism from O'Reilly's presence. Brahms's tragic C minor quartet probably began as his expression of sorrow over the death of his friend Robert Schumann and his own hopeless love for Clara Schumann. If this sounds like the plot of a late 1940s movie, you're right. It was called Song of Love, and it starred Katharine Hepburn, Paul Henreid, and Robert Walker as Brahms. But it wasn't nearly as moving as this performance of the quartet. The performers are Arturo Del Moni, Marcus Thompson, Ronald Thomas, and Mihai Lee. They're all playing at their extraordinary best, and Northeastern Records has recorded them superbly. The next recording by the Boston Chamber Music Society will be trios by Tchaikovsky and Shostakovich. I look forward to it.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed two new Brahms discs by the Boston Chamber Music Society on the Northeastern label. Today's edition of Fresh Air was produced by Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Bob Alls, and Thad Kirk. Chris Burton directs the show. I'm Marty Moscowane.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, we talk tennis with sports writer John Feinstein. His new book, Hard Courts, looks at how tennis went from a game most sports fans ignored to a high-pressure multi-million dollar business. That and more on the next Fresh Air.